Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone, I am Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast, and as always, I am seeking to bring you the very best in apologetics and scholarly information, and we've got a real treat for you today. And you're talking about bringing the best, and might I say that, as of today, I think this will be the year anniversary of our show. Our first podcast was aired on March 2nd. And so here it is, March 1st. I think that's close enough. So we've come a long way, and we've got an excellent guest here for you. He got his PhD at Claremont in California in New Testament. He's the author of numerous books, including one of my favorites of Fabricating Jesus, interviewed by Lee Strobel in Case for a Real Jesus, an authority on Dead Sea Scrolls, archaeology, and so much else related to the New Testament. My guest is Professor Craig Evans here on the line today. Professor Evans, are you there?
I'm here, Nick. Good to be with you.
It is very good to have you here. I announced my show last week with, I was interviewing Lynn Cowick, and when I said that you were going to be on next week, she said, I'm going to be listening.
Oh, Lynn's a great scholar. I admire her work very much.
Well, I'm sure she's very thrilled right now. But some of my listeners might actually not know much about you, so tell me about how you got to be doing what you're doing today. What got you into this field exactly?
Well, when I was in university about 40 years ago, I was a history major and a philosophy minor, and I was at a very elite college preparing for law school. But just at the very beginning of my senior year, I had a change of heart. I sensed God's call to go into Christian ministry instead. So I went to seminary, a three-year program, which results in the Master of Divinity degree in Portland, Oregon. While doing that, I really enjoyed the academic side of my studies. I enjoyed Greek and Hebrew and getting into the history and context, background, and so on of biblical studies and Jesus and Christian origins. And so although I continued to move toward ordination, and I was ordained, and in fact I was on the staff of a couple of churches and worked with youth and so on, I went ahead and pursued a PhD, and that's why I went to Claremont, as you mentioned a moment ago, and I pursued the PhD in biblical studies in general, but the specialty ended up being in New Testament, though interestingly enough, my dissertation was on the book of Isaiah, and so I was very much into Old Testament as well, and I had become really interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls and early Jewish texts, thanks to the influence of people like the late William Brownlee, and the still very much alive and well James Sanders, who had just founded the Ancient Biblical Manuscript Center at Claremont. And those were exciting days. You know, we were calling for the scrolls to finally get published. And there were some archaeological discoveries. There were new excavations going on in Jerusalem in the aftermath of, you know, the recent wars there, which enabled Israel to gain control of all of Israel, including all of Jerusalem. So it was these were exciting times and full of opportunities. So that's how I got my start. I went to Canada in 1980. I was at McMaster for 1 year. Then I went to British Columbia, where I was at Trinity Western University for 21 years, 1981 to 2002. And since 2002, I've been at Acadia, which is out east in Nova Scotia, which is where I am now, which is where I'm sitting at the moment talking to you. And I've continued my work very much focused on the historical Jesus, and that would include Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, Jesus and archaeology. I look at the very old manuscripts, the oldest papyri and codices of the Greek New Testament. And it's a very exciting field of work. I find it very refreshing, very enriching personally. It's a lot of fun to speak at apologetics conferences and academic conferences, presenting papers, writing books, and doing all sorts of things like that. So that's how I started, and that's what I've been doing, and that brings us right up to today.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more on so many things. I've got my own interests and hobbies that I do, but somehow nothing seems to light up a personality nearly as much as getting to have a good intellectual discussion on matters of Christianity and apologetics and such. It's just something totally different. So let's get on to talking about what we're talking about today, the Dead Sea Scrolls. I remember hearing about William Albright when he was notified about the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. He congratulated the person on finding the greatest archaeological finding of our time. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes, I do. It's extraordinary when you think about it. There are at least 900 scrolls. We don't have a final count yet. We may never, simply because there are 20,000 small fragments, and so we sort through them trying to figure out how many texts or parts of texts have we really recovered. The other thing is that some fragments continue to come to light. Some of the Bedouin apparently still possess, and maybe some collectors still possess, some of the fragments of scrolls found from those original 11 caves discovered in the 1940s and 1950s. Now, you quoted William F. Albright. That was a note that he sent to John Trevor. I studied with John Trevor at Claremont. Near the end of his career, he relocated to Claremont and was linked to the Ancient Biblical Manuscript Center that I mentioned a few minutes ago. And John Trevor, in 1947, 1948, was in Israel along with William Brownlee. William Brownlee and John stayed together and got to know each other and became close friends for the rest of their lives. And so I had the privilege of studying under both of those men. I actually saw John Trevor's photographs, his own personal photographs, that he had. Many of them were framed and mounted on the wall. That's how I saw the first photographs of the great Isaiah scroll, for example. And William Brownlee actually was my doctoral supervisor, and so I wrote my dissertation under his direction. So those were very, very heady days back then. And when you find nearly 1,000 documents that reach all the way back to the time of Jesus and a couple hundred years earlier in some cases, just about every Old Testament book is represented. Only Esther is missing of the 66 Old Testament books, or of the 39 Old Testament books. That's quite extraordinary. And then numerous other texts, commentaries on the Old Testament, especially on Isaiah, some of the other prophets and Psalms, rule books on how to live and how to maintain purity and that sort of thing. books about expecting a great war, you know, the war scroll texts and all of that. We just learned a huge amount of what was going on, especially as it related to understanding Scripture in the time of Jesus and just before. So it shed all kinds of light on Jesus in the early church. Some of the texts clarify for us important teaching in Paul's letters or in James or in Hebrews, in the Gospel of John, in some of the synoptic gospels. And so, you know, how do you do better than that? It's just amazing. So I do agree with the great archaeologist William F. Albright. I think he was not exaggerating when he very generously congratulated John Trevor and Bill Brownlee and said, you know, you have made the greatest discovery relating to the Bible that's ever been made. And John Trevor published his photographs. Everybody began looking for more caves. Hundreds of more documents were found. And the rest is, as they say, history. And, of course, we're still studying them. We're still piecing together fragments. We're still writing books and trying to understand these scrolls better and making them relate to archaeology and other texts that have been found as well. And so it's just an exciting time to be a biblical scholar and a biblical historian. It's just never been a better time. So, Nick, you know, what can I say? I encourage your audience, many of you, you people who are listening, to take some courses. Visit Israel if you can. Go visit Qumran. See the sites. Go to the museum, the Shrine of the Book. See the scrolls. Learn something. I'll be there in June myself, once again, at a dig in Jerusalem at Mount Zion, and also a dig or two up in Galilee. So these are exciting times. There's still a lot to learn. It's not all done. It's not all finished. In some ways, we're just scratching the surface, and most of the work still lies before us.
Yeah, my wife knows whenever we go anywhere and we see something about a trip to Israel and such, I'm always paying attention because I definitely want to go to Israel someday. And now, you've talked about the impact of the Dead Sea Scrolls a little bit and such. Perhaps we should go backwards a little bit. There's a lot of stories out there about the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Could you tell us what really happened? How did we find the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Well, the first cave was discovered, we believe, in 1947. And there is a little bit of mystery about that. I think there always will be, because the Bedouin, the Palestinians, who were native to the area, who originally found the first cave, the story was not always told the same way, so we have to be careful. I wouldn't put a lot of money on it. But, you know, the old story is throwing rocks into a cave, perhaps trying to scare a goat or something that was missing or whatever, some kind of story like that. In any case, a stone went into a cave, an opening, and it made a strange sound when the stone struck something, the sound of pottery breaking. And this made the Bedouin goat herder suspicious. He thought, wait a minute, that wasn't the right sound. There's something in that cave. So he had to reach up to the hole and pull himself up. It was difficult to get into this small cave. And then when he dropped down inside, much to his surprise, there were all these jars. And apparently there were scrolls inside some of these jars, and scrolls perhaps not in the jars, fragments and so on. So he just grabbed a handful, and he was disappointed. He was hoping to find treasure. Of course, he was finding treasure. And so that's how some of the first scrolls were found, and he showed it to different people, and eventually the patriarch of the Eastern Church, Mar Samuel, he saw them and suspected they were valuable. It's just a question of how old were they. And he passed them around, and eventually the great Jewish scholar Eliezer Lipa Sukenik, he saw them in November of 1947, and he recognized their value. But see, he couldn't access. He was on the Jewish side of the Green Line at that time. The city was divided, and Mar Samuel and the Palestinians were on the eastern side, and so it was difficult for him to purchase. He did eventually purchase a few of these scrolls. Meanwhile, others were taken to the Americans at the Palestine Archaeological Museum, now the Rockefeller Museum, and that's where John Trevor saw some, the Great Isaiah Scroll being one of them. And so he was keenly interested in it and asked permission to photograph them, and permission was granted, and he photographed them in February of 1948. So that's how this all got started, and pretty soon the hunt was on to find more caves. And of course, in 1948, as you know, in May, Israel became a country and was immediately attacked. So we had a civil war, and the boundaries were got shifted around, and things were happening, and bullets were flying, and they were very exciting and, for some, very dangerous days. So that was the first cave that was discovered, we think, in 1947. We guess probably in April or May of that year. And then in the following years, several more caves were discovered. In 1952, right up to 1956, 10 more caves were discovered. Cave 4, found in 1952, has about two-thirds of the entire collection. There's more than 600 documents of the 900-plus, whatever the final count will be. So, and then as I said a little while ago in our program, there's still fragments that show up that are in personal possession of some of these Bedouin and other collectors. Even Kando, the famous antiquities dealer who had a shop in Bethlehem, still does, his grandson. And he acquired some of these scrolls and scroll fragments from some of these Bedouin, and then in turn he sold them to Suketic's son, Yigal Yadin, and sometimes he was coerced into selling these too. That's an interesting story. And apparently his family still owns some scroll fragments that are under lock and key in a safe deposit box, apparently in Switzerland. So there's always this mystery swirling around the scrolls, which is why people write fictional books. That's why Dan Brown and others write stories about conspiracies and stuff like that, because they hear these kinds of stories and they go, oh man, this is exciting. There's got to be a plot. There's got to be some kind of story behind this, some kind of conspiracy. There really isn't, but in any case, people like to run with it and have a lot of fun. So it's an exciting field, and I think more texts will come to light. I don't think we're going to find a cave full of hundreds, but there'll still be a few more texts that come to light and that will shed light on interesting questions. I don't have any doubt about it.
I'm sure we'll be talking about some conspiracies and such, so we can deal with a lot of misinformation, but since you mentioned Dan Brown, it's worth noting, in fact, that in his novel, it's supposed to have all these historical facts right. He even gets the date of a finding of a Dead Sea Scrolls wrong, which is something
well,
you could have found out.
Does.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Nick, I have read Dan Brown's book, and I don't think it's a great book in any case, but it is full of errors. And his fictional character, Sir Lee Teabing, speaks as if there's only one cave that had all the scrolls. He was wrong on that.
Yep.
There are times where he's not even sure what language they were written in. There's errors relating to the Gnostic codices. And, of course, a lot of silliness about romance between Jesus and Mary, or the idea that the scrolls even talk about Jesus and Mary. They don't, of course. I've read every text at Qumran. Jesus is not mentioned. Mary Magdalene is not mentioned. No Christian is mentioned. The Christian church is not mentioned. No child of Jesus is mentioned. None of that is in the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's just poppycock and fiction. Dan Brown very naively, very gullibly got this from another book that the late Michael Bagent and some of his colleagues wrote called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. That book came out in 1982, and it's just full of errors. It's a conspiracy book, and Dan Brown naively thought that it actually was legitimate history.
And he
accepted that as history and then built his fictional murder mystery around it, and complete with all this nonsense about Jesus and Mary and having a child and a secret society called the Priory Sion, which supposedly all this truth is somehow contained in the scrolls, which, of course, the Vatican wants to suppress. And that's just nothing but nonsense.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be asking some more questions, and I'll get out the numbers so we can start taking your calls. I'm Nick Peters, the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Professor Craig Evans. We'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
I can't believe the news today. Oh, I can't believe.
And we're back. My guest is Professor Craig Evans. We're talking about Christianity and the Dead Sea Scrolls. We just got done talking about the Da Vinci Code a little bit, and I'm not sure if some of my readers know it, but Lee Teabing, the main intellectual character in that book, who's supposed to be giving all this information, his name is in fact a respelling of Vagent, one of these conspiracy writers who Professor Evans just talked about. And Professor Evans, where do these people get these ideas? Do you have any idea? Or?
Well, I think part of it is they get information. Some of the information they actually do understand and they get right. Some of the information they misunderstand. And then the rest of it is imagination. Now, sometimes I suspect they have an axe to grind. And I really think that the late Michael Vagent, he died, I think, last spring of 2013. But I think there's an axe to grind. I think it's willful and intentional. There was a hoax that was started in the late 1950s and early 1960s in France, in southwestern France, and this is where it all got underway. And there supposedly was a priory of Sion, and the hoaxers, of course, are long dead now. But one of them's name was Pierre Plantard. Now, he later did admit in court on fraud charges. He was a fraudster and made up this cock and bull story that he supposedly was a bloodline descendant of Jesus. This is what was so crazy about it. And so his way of explaining that was, well, Mary Magdalene was Jesus' wife, and they had a daughter. And this daughter had somehow managed to get to France and actually became the founder of a dynasty, some kind of a royal dynasty, and that this Pierre Plantard was claiming to be a descendant. Of course, the whole thing was nonsense. And he and a couple of other fakers produced documents that supposedly went back to the Middle Ages, some kind of old French and Latin documents, and they became known as the secret papers. And they're actually in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, and they'll readily tell you if you want to see them. They'll show you pictures of them, say, yeah, they're modern, they're fakes, they were made in the 20th century, they're not ancient, they don't go back to the Middle Ages. So Michael Vagent used to work for the BBC, and so they were actually doing an investigative report on this legend, this rumor of the 1970s that supposedly there was this secret society, and Leonardo da Vinci, Sir Isaac Newton, and a few others were presidents or leaders of this secret society at one time or another over the last 800-900 years. And, of course, it was all baloney. There was no truth to it. And that's what the BBC discovered and decided not to pursue it further. But Michael Vagent wanted to pursue it. He sensed that there was a book that he could write. And so he did that with Richard Lee. And that's where the Lee comes from, Lee Teabing. Richard mm-hmm. Lee and Henry Lincoln wrote this book. And they published it, as I said earlier, in 1982, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And of course, the whole thing is a cock and bull story. And unfortunately, you know, there were a lot of people who took it seriously and thought, oh, at last we have the truth. You know, the Vatican, as usual, is involved in a conspiracy to cover things up. And, of course, none of that was true. And scholars didn't take that book seriously. But unfortunately, the general public, some people in the general public were fooled by it and actually thought that it was real research, that there really was such a priory of Sion, a secret society, that there really was some kind of mystery and secret papers that the church was trying to hide and so forth. And one of the people fooled by that was a very gullible person, formerly a high school teacher with no training in either history or Greek or Hebrew or Dead Sea Scrolls or archaeology or biblical interpretation, and that's Dan Brown. And so Dan wrote that book in the late 1990s. It was published in 2003, and he had been trying for years to be a popular writer. And this book, of course, exploded on the scene and was a record bestseller. And of course, it was turned into a movie in 2006, starring Tom Hanks. And, you know, I don't know, 40, 50 million copies of his book sold. It's estimated there were 100 million readers in English and other languages, And, of course, several million people watch what I thought was a rather boring film.
Oh, yes.
As one reviewer said, watching the Da Vinci Code movie was watching Tom Hanks for 2 hours looking confused. And so that's what it was. And so it did. It left a lot of people confused and bewildered, which is too bad. And so I and a bunch of others have been trying ever since to set the record straight and tell people, look, it isn't just a fictional murder mystery, as Dan Brown wrote it, but the entire basis on which it's founded, this Priory of Sion thing, these secret papers, Jesus and Mary having a child, this whole thing is entirely a hoax, and there's not an ounce of truth in it.
Yeah, I remember when I went to see the movie, when it got towards the end, I remember thinking, 10 more minutes and it's going to be over. And 10 minutes passed, and 10 more minutes, please say it's over. And 10 minutes passed, and it's finally, for the love of God, let it be over in 10 minutes. It was just,
yeah, I tell you, Nick, I agree with you, Nick. That was my feeling. The middle of it was painful. It was just, oh my goodness, like, you know, let's get to it, please. Yeah. And it was a very dull movie, and the plot didn't make any sense either. You know, when you think about it, the plot was silly. You know, you had this, and by the way, it was very insensitive, and I thought almost slanderous the way Opus Dei, it's a Catholic lay organization, has about 85,000 members. Opus Dei is made up of Catholic lay people and some priests too. You know, and you can join if you're a Catholic, and it's just devoted to good works, charity, things like that, taking faith seriously, being a devout Catholic, and so on. And it was vilified. It was made to look like a dangerous secret society. The person that was murdering people was Silas, the albino monk. You know, I mean, my goodness. And what was so silly about the plot was the whole idea was Opus Dei is trying to keep secret the Priory of Sion. So if you want to keep it a secret, then why do you go around killing people? It just all it did was call attention to it, lead to a police investigation. And, you know, so the whole plot, it just didn't make any sense either. And, you know, the whole thing was unfortunate. And that was one of the things I wanted to make clear when I did a lot of speaking. I probably spoke 50 times between 2003 and 2006 because people wanted to know, what is this Da Vinci Code? Is there any truth in it? Do the Dead Sea Scrolls talk about Jesus or not? And one of the things that concerned me was this group, Opus Dei. I mean, I have many Roman Catholic friends, and some of them are members of Opus Dei. Mm-hmm. And to be so maligned like that and to be made out as a dangerous secret society, you know, I thought that was very unfortunate. Now, ironically, Opus Dei's membership actually increased because they became better known and people were defending them. People mm-hmm. said, well, what are they all about? And when they looked at them closely, they thought, hey, that's a good group. I'd like to join. So it actually had the good effect of expanding their membership a little bit because of this notoriety.
Yeah, I actually, in fact, see the coming of a Da Vinci Code as actually a good thing. The same reason I see the coming of a new atheist as a good thing, because, hey, they're getting the conversation started for us, and if we got the facts on our side, my God, that just makes the case easier for us.
Well, you're right about that. I attended a debate with an atheist Wednesday night of this week. And one of my colleagues debated this person, and this particular atheist isn't real happy about the new atheists. He calls them sunshine atheists, thinks they have a very naive view that somehow the world will be a better place if Christians disappeared, if everybody who believes in God just sort of went away. He doesn't think the world will become a better place at all. He thinks the world will actually become a scarier and more dangerous place, which mm-hmm. I thought was really interesting. And so the new atheists and some of their loud negative claims, they have, in fact, made people stop and think. And because a lot of people don't think much about it. They don't think much about God. They're not sure. They're sort of passive agnostics. And so the new atheists have, I think, brought to everyone's mind how important it is to think about God, to ask the big questions, like, who are we as humans? Where did we come from? Why are we here? Do we have any purpose? Where are we going? What's our future? And these are very important questions. And people, I think a lot of people are asleep and they don't ask those questions, and they should. So in that sense, New Atheism, you know, in a sense, has done a public service and just waking people up.
Mm-hmm. What I can hear some skeptics out there saying with all this, though, is, where, of course, Professor Evans is going to think that all this stuff in the Da Vinci Code is nonsense because he's a good conservative scholar, but that's not just a conservative position. If we brought the most liberal New Testament scholars in here, they'd be agreeing with us as well, wouldn't they?
Well, that's right. One of the best written books that refutes the Da Vinci Code and exposes its silliness was written by Bart Ehrman.
Mm-hmm.
Bart Ehrman, a very well-known skeptic. He doesn't consider himself a Christian anymore, and hasn't for many years. And so he's not trying to be conservative. He's not trying to defend the Bible or defend the Christian faith or defend the church or defend the Vatican. And his expose, I think, is very, very well thought out, very well informed, and he shows how utterly silly just about everything in the Da Vinci Code is. It's just full of mistakes, and of course it's based on the egregiously erroneous and mistaken Holy Blood, Holy Grail book by Michael Bajan and his colleagues, as I said a little while ago. So, yeah, you don't have to be, you know, a conservative Christian or traditional or something like that. Lots of historians, lots of secular writers have criticized severely the Da Vinci Code, noting that it's just full of mistakes regarding history, architecture, documents, things like that, you know. And so, no, it's not just a conservative Christian complaint about it, but it's criticism coming from everywhere, from Jews, from non-Christians, from liberals, you know, from conservatives, from people in the church, people outside the church. Everybody has pointed out how it's full of fallacies and mistakes.
I think something we can get out of this, and it's a lesson I wish more people would learn, as one who debates so many atheists on the internet, and usually all I get are memes and soundbite arguments and such from popular websites, and that's to please always check scholarly sources. And at this point, I don't care if you're conservative, liberal, atheist, Christian, go look at scholarly resources before posting a lot of claims, because there are so many claims put up there as nonsense. For instance, I still hear people say, we have a scholar still debate as to whether Jesus even existed. No. No, they don't. Sorry. They do not debate this anymore. I mean, wouldn't you agree with us that the number one thing people need
right.
to start doing? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head, Nick. That's so true. In fact, I could mention that same skeptical scholar, Bart Ehrman. He published a book last year, Did Jesus Exist?
Excellent.
And, you know, and he does. He makes, you know, a very crisp, succinct argument. He doesn't misuse the facts. He reasons very, very well. Of course Jesus existed, and here's the evidence for it. And among other things, he talks about how there were people who knew him, and we have letters from people who knew those people. And so, you know, he mentions the Apostle Paul. Paul was a skeptic. Paul did not believe in Jesus. Paul had no axe to grind in support of the Christian church, at least not initially. He then became converted. He saw the risen Jesus. That changed his mind. And, of course, he wanted to learn more about his new faith. So what did he do? He visited Peter, who was Jesus' number one disciple, and he visited James. And James was Jesus's brother. And so, you know, there was absolutely no doubt in his mind that Jesus existed, was a real person. He met countless other people who knew Jesus, and that would include Barnabas, was one of his traveling companions. Because, you know, you had to know Jesus. You had to be a witness of his resurrection to be an apostolic figure. And Paul got to know them.
Mm-hmm.
And Bart Ehrman wisecracks, I think it's a great line in his book, in Did Jesus Exist? He says, if Jesus didn't exist, you'd think his brother James would know that. And I thought, you know, way to go, Bart. You know, that was well said. And but yet there are still skeptics. There are still skeptics out there. And I wonder, are they really open? Are they open-minded? Are they really open to the evidence? I suspect not. They've got an axe. They want to grind.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't matter. You know, they'll say Nazareth never existed. And it doesn't matter what evidence there is for Nazareth. They know apparently better than the Jewish and Christian archaeologists who are professionals. There are skeptics who will say, you know, you can't trust any of the sources, so I guess they're better, they're smarter than all the historians and all the biblical scholars put together. I mean, on they go. Who are these guys? They don't have proper degrees. They're not proper academics. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't read papers or publish papers in recognized, properly refereed journals. They're quacky and they're off in the corner. You know, they're right up there with the ufologists, that is the people who specialize in UFO studies, Bigfoot, and everything else. So, you know, what do you do with a group like that? You know, you just shake your head, and the real scholars continue doing their work. People who are professors at Ivy League universities, real intellectuals, and not mm-hmm. these quacks and internet skeptics who are just talking among themselves.
Let's get back to the Dead Sea Scrolls a bit now. It's my understanding that after they found, a team was sent over of 7 scholars to begin the initial investigations. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that sounds right. And they were mostly Roman Catholic, which is why, by the way, the Vatican always is accused of being involved in a conspiracy to prevent the scrolls from being published. But there were people like J.T. Billick, John Strugnell, Father Roland DeVoe, Maurice Bayet, John Allegro, who kind of embarrassed the team later.
Yeah, we'll be talking about him.
Yeah, Frank Moore Cross, and some young understudies who were getting underway in their careers, like Raymond Brown and Joseph Fitzmyer. I mean, a lot of people don't know that. They're the guys that filled out the note cards that created the glossary or the index that my colleague Marty Abag later published. That's how he reconstructed the unpublished texts and began publishing them in the early to middle 90s. So, you know, there were a lot of very talented people. And I forgot to mention Sean Starkey as well. Then these people, you know, they went and visited the Dead Sea region. They excavated at Qumran. They searched the caves. They hired some of the Bedouin to work with them and examine every single cave, all the dust. And this was hard work. In the summertime, it was horribly hot. And the dust, you had to wear masks, otherwise you'd just be breathing it right into your lungs. And some of that was bat and bird dung, if you can imagine. And, you know, it was not the most pleasant working conditions. And recovering these fragments, you know, some of them are the size of a postage stamp, and thousands of fragments. And a lot of people think, oh, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're all scrolls. Only a handful were actually scrolls still rolled up. Many of them were just pieces of paper like confetti, just torn up, small pieces. Some were rolled up but glued together. You couldn't unroll them. Like the Genesis Apocryphon scroll was very difficult. The most famous one, perhaps, from Cave 3 was made of copper, rolled up. It was a copper plaque that had been rolled up, pieces riveted together. It had completely corroded, of course, so it was green. And you can't unroll, you know, something like that. It would just shatter. So they had to come up with the technology, and they did it at Manchester, where the copper scroll was neatly cut into pieces and unrolled that way in strips. And it turned out to be a list of treasures and where they're hidden, millions of dollars worth today if these treasures were to be recovered. So on it goes. It's just a fascinating collection of material. And, of course, the team got larger and larger, especially when Emmanuel Tove took over in 1990. He expanded the team, and it went from just a handful of scholars who are now getting very old to more than 50 people. And including my colleagues Marty Abeg and Peter Flint when I was at Trinity, where we founded the Dead Sea Scrolls Institute. So because there was all these people working on it, then very quickly, the next 15 years or so, the rest of the scrolls were published, including the many, many fragments and the DJD series, the Discoveries in the Judean Desert series, published by Oxford University Press, finally got completed, publishing 39, 40 volumes in all. So it's quite a history, and it was quite a Herculean job, but it finally did get finished.
Well, we're going to have to take another quick break at that. I'm Nick Peters, the Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Professor Craig Evans, and we are talking about Christianity and the Dead Sea Scrolls. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And we're back. My guest is Professor Craig Evans. We are talking about Christianity and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, it's also my understanding that it was a few years, I think 7 years before, the first findings were released to the public on the Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, they knew they'd been found, but the first information about what they contained was released then. Is that accurate?
Well, it could be. Depends on what's considered information, I guess, because Cave 1 was found in 47, and in 1948, John Trevor photographed four of these scrolls, including the Great Isaiah Scroll and the what was called the Manual of Discipline, or the Rule Scroll, the Rule of the Community. Well, those were published initially in 1948, so it's just a year later. I don't know how it could have been done any quicker. Mm-hmm. And Bill Brownlee published in 48 and 49 some of the very first articles. He was talking about the Manual of Discipline and also the Habakkuk commentary, the Pesher on Habakkuk. And this was happening in the late 40s and early 50s, before the other caves were even found. So I would say it's not exactly true to say that it was seven whole years that went by. Of course, you know, so the finds were over a period of 10 years, from 1947 to 1956. So, in a sense, nobody was in any position to talk about all of the scrolls for many years, simply because they weren't all found all at once. Mm-hmm. So I think you need to put it in that light. So things were getting published pretty quickly as they were being found. Mm-hmm. What happened was, in 1952, when K4 was discovered, and, you know, and some 600 scrolls and many, many thousands of fragments were pulled out of that cave, that's when things really slowed down. And mm-hmm. so the original team, that small number that was originally established shortly before that huge discovery, they just weren't numerous enough. They just didn't have the manpower. It was unmanageable. This find was so huge. And I think it took them by surprise, because Cave 1, you know, that was a walk in the park. I mean, you know, the Genesis Apocryphon was a bit of a challenge, and yeah, there were some fragments. But most of these scrolls, you just unrolled them. The text was easy to see, easy to transcribe, not tough to translate. And so publication was greatly facilitated. But it was a different story when they, you know, Caves 2 and 3 didn't have very many scrolls in them, so it was a manageable group. But when they found Cave 4, they were just swamped with materials. And so while they were sorting that out, Caves 5, 6, 7, you know, one by one, more caves were discovered. And that original group was overwhelmed. And I think that's why the delay sat in. I mean, a lot of stuff continued to be published in the 1960s. 1970s, but by the early 80s, the pace had slowed down to a trickle, and people mm-hmm. were getting impatient. There were rumors that there were some really fascinating fragments found in K4, the Son of God text, for example, 4Q246, the Messianic Apocalypse text, 4Q521, and some others, and people were saying, hey, let's get these things published. But the easy stuff had already been published. This was all hard now, and there weren't enough people. And I think a little bit of selfishness kicked in. There were a couple of scholars who, I think they should have been a little more generous and should have opened things up and allowed others to help and see text, you know. I don't know. There were some problems that began to develop in the 70s, and it wasn't until Emanuel Tov took over 1990, as I said, that those problems finally got addressed.
I think it's important because that's another thing that these conspiracy theorists go after, I say, where there was a slowdown because we were trying to cover up something that we found in the scrolls that was damaging to Christianity.
Yeah, you're right, and that is exactly what some people like Michael Bagent, that we talked about earlier, also John Allegro, he was alleging the same thing, that there were real embarrassing secrets, and that all these Roman Catholics that were on the team didn't want these things to leak out. Well, he was coming up with real screwy stuff, you know, this magic hallucinatory mushroom and all that, and that was embarrassing to the team. And so, you know, when Allegro started making these allegations and he even went on to write a book about the sacred mushroom, this was humiliating and terribly embarrassing for these scholars. And, of course, one by one, they came out either on the radio or in newsprint or magazines or whatever saying, we disavow this. This guy's speaking for himself. And some people wanted to interpret that as, see, they're ganging up on this guy because this guy wants to tell the truth. He wants to let the secrets out. But that was just poppycock. There was nothing to it at all. But anyway, that did create a context, this illusion that maybe there is a conspiracy and the Roman Catholics are behind it somehow, and they don't want the scrolls to get out because they reveal embarrassing things, either about Jesus or the church or whatever.
Yeah, I did have an internet atheist a few weeks ago even recommend the sacred mushroom and it crossed me, and it was, I don't know how I kept from laughing at that point. And I even understand that in the London Telegraph there was an ad taken out publicly by 13 scholars disavowing the book, and that the publisher even apologized for publishing it.
Well, yeah, you can see, like, I would be humiliated if I were part of a team of scholars working on some project, and then one of the members of the team went rogue and started making all kinds of crazy claims. That would be embarrassing. You know, it could harm your own. In fact, my own experience with the Gospel of Judas, it wasn't that bad, but it was similar because somebody on the team had mistranslated parts of the Gospel of Judas, and this became very clear later. And I felt a little annoyed, you know, that here we were talking about the significance of this text, and it had been reconstructed a bit oddly in a place or two, and a couple of emendations had been made unnecessarily. And it just, there were four places in the text where it just wasn't quite right. And all four of these places that weren't quite right helped advance a questionable interpretation. And so although this was relatively minor, and the media went crazy, you know, I'm talking about back in April of 2006, I felt a little bit betrayed. I felt a little bit irked. So I could easily imagine how scholars like John Strugnell and Frank Cross and some of these other people back in the 1960s and 70s when Allegro went rogue on them and started making these remarkable claims and talking about how there's a conspiracy and people don't want to let these things out and trying to hide things, I can see how they, you know, would become very unhappy with him. And they did the right thing. They went public and said, look, there's no truth to this stuff. I mean, you know, there's no conspiracy here. We have the text in front of us. They simply don't say these things. They don't support these things. You know, Mr. Allegro has got an agenda. He's doing something, and doesn't make any sense to us.
And it wasn't just conservative Christians in this group either, was it?
Oh, no. It was everybody involved. I mean, one of the early scrolls translators is Lancaster Harding. There are some great pictures of him. I mean, the carelessness back then. I mean, Lancaster Harding's got a cigarette in his mouth and a and an ash on the end of his cigarette an inch long, and it's hanging precariously right over one of these scrolls. Nobody mm-hmm. does that now, trust me, but back then mm-hmm. they were smoking and handling the scrolls with their bare fingers. They were using scotch tape to put the fragments together. They did all kinds of things today that are anathema. But I mentioned Mr. Harding because he was agnostic. He was not a religious person. And of course, he disavowed all this nonsense with Allegro. I mean, you know, he was a serious scroll scholar, a curator of the Palestine Archaeological Museum. He was involved in recovering the scrolls, interpreting them, conserving them, and everything else. And he didn't go along with all this silliness. And he had no particular religious axe to grind. He wasn't trying to defend Roman Catholics or conservative Protestants. He was just trying to get at the truth and stick with the facts. And so he didn't agree with Allegro at all.
Well, since we've talked some about the scrolls and our finding, we should also talk about their origin. So that's sort of a question. Who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think we know the answer to that. Our ancient historians, going back 2,000 years, talk about, and I'm talking about a Roman historian for one, his name is Pliny the Elder.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote what's called Natural History, and he died in the year 79 when Vesuvius erupted. Unfortunately for him, he had to get close for a better look, and he got a little too close. Well, he traveled through Israel, and he talks about the Dead Sea, and he says at the northwest shore, near a place called En Gedi, there are these guys called Essenes, and they live by themselves there. Well, what he described is where Qumran is. It's the northwest shore of the Dead Sea, just, you know, not that far from En Gedi. And then there are two or three other historians, including Josephus and Philo, and they refer to these guys, and they'll pronounce their name either Essene, Essenoi, or Essioi. Most scholars think that that word means, Essene, is actually from the Hebrew. It's a participle, and it's a masculine plural, and it means those who do. It's from the verb Essa. And when you read the scrolls, you'll see that they talk about those who do, and they use the verb asa, those who do the law, those who keep or do the covenant, the berit. And that's language, by the way, very similar to the New Testament book of James, where it talks about those who are doers of the word, not hearers only. So we think the Essenes are the doers. And, of course, where do we find the scrolls? In the northwest shore of the Dead Sea at a place called Qumran. This is where the ancient writers said these guys lived. They're called Essenes. We find texts in which they speak of themselves as Essenes, as doers of the covenant or the law. So, you know, you put 2 + 2 together, and I'm sorry, every time you do that, it comes up as 4. Now, some people say, oh, well, we don't know that. You know, this is a risky, you know, connection, but we don't know of Essenes anywhere else except at that place. The ancient writers do not refer to any other group other than at that place. So I think a very cautious interpretation is to make that linkage, and that's why it is the majority view. Now, that doesn't mean that all of the scrolls that were found at Qumran in those 11 caves, that every single one was written by somebody at Qumran or written by an Essene. No one claims that. Many of these scrolls came from somewhere else in Israel. But what we're talking about are the key scrolls, the sectarian ones, the scrolls relating to their rules, the Sarek scrolls, the Hodayot, the hymn scrolls, the Pesharim, the commentaries. There are some key scrolls, the war scrolls. There are certain scrolls they composed. And they probably copied out some of the scripture scrolls too, but they didn't, you know, invent the scriptures. They inherited them and made their own copies. Some of the other writings, dozens of other writings, were scrolls that were simply added to their library. Just as you or I have books at home, we don't write them all. I've written several, but I have lots of other books that somebody else wrote, and I want them because I find them useful and helpful and so on. So it's a library. And so some of the scrolls they wrote, some of them they merely copied. others they collected, and it's their own library. And of that library, we've recovered over 900, as I said earlier. Very few of them are complete and whole. Most of them are in fragments. And so it's an Essene library, and that's the way it should be understood. Not that the Essenes wrote all of them. That would be a mistake.
Right. Now, for those who are interested also in the history, when you talk about Pliny the Younger, the Elder, I was wanting to remind you of that. The movie Pompeii, that's out right now. I haven't got to see it yet, but it's about that eruption that Pliny the Elder died in.
Yeah, you're right. That's right. I haven't seen the movie either, although one of my students did, and he was quite excited about it. He wasn't too sure about how good the plot was, but he said the special effects were quite effective. Now, you know, Pompeii and Herculaneum are of great interest to me because they preserve the cities just the way they were. It's a snapshot in time in the year 79 when it happened. And I'm especially interested in all the graffiti written on the walls because that's evidence of literacy. And the graffiti, like any document or text, like these scrolls we're talking about found in caves, well, these are documents written on walls on the outside and sometimes even on the inside of buildings, and they were preserved by that volcanic ash. So, for scholars, you never know. Treasures can show up in the most interesting locations and under the most odd circumstances. But, you know, when Vesuvius spewed out all that hot gas and ash and buried these two cities right there at Naples, you know, that helps us today learn about how people lived in Rome in the year 79. And as you said, this is the very volcanic eruption that claimed the life of Pliny the Elder. Mm-hmm. By the way, his nephew, or his adopted son, Pliny Jr., became governor in Asia Minor, and he writes about Christians in a letter to Emperor Trajan in the year 110. So the two Plinys are interesting people, one shedding light on Qumran and the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Essenes, and the other one shedding light on early Christians at the beginning of the second century. A very interesting family.
I also think it's worthwhile, as I point out with skeptics all the time, that Pliny the Younger, who wrote about this event to Tacitus, is at the time our only real sort of eyewitness account to this major event, and we don't even have an account about the destruction of the cities from a real historical source until a century later. So take that for consideration for those who use these arguments from silence all the time with ancient history.
Well, you make a good point there, Nick, because skeptics who make that kind of argument, like they'll say, well, nobody talks about Nazareth prior to the Gospels being written, you know, as if that, wow, that's important. Well, there are all kinds of things from antiquity that nobody refers to or nobody mentions, and we find them later, or they are mentioned, but centuries later. So what? So what some of these skeptics do, they pick and choose. They choose to be skeptical when it suits their theory, and their theory usually is either Jesus didn't exist, or there was no Nazareth, or nothing happened, or nobody knew what he said, or whatever their skepticism is. They then base it on a very, very selective skepticism, a very selective way of arguing from silence, and that's why real historians ignore them, because that's not how real historians operate.
Well, we're going to go ahead right early and take another break, and we'll be back with Professor Craig Evans after this.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok? Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grok as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told, every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back. This week we're talking with Professor Craig Evans about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, if you're listening next week, coming straight out of HBU, my guest is going to be Mary Jo Sharp. And we're going to be talking about why apologetics? Why should anyone study this? Why should anyone do it? What difference does it make? HBU's Mary Jo Sharp. It should be a fascinating show here. For now, we're talking with Professor Craig Evans about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, you said these were written by the Essenes. I was in a discussion with my wife recently, and I used a line from Robert Gagnon about the Essenes, because we were talking about the on marriage in Matthew 19 and how the Pharisees had one view. I said, you know how whenever we read the New Testament, we see the Pharisees as people who are very strict about following the law, want to make sure we got it right? I said, yeah. I said, well, to the Essenes, the Pharisees were wimps. Do you think that's an accurate description of the Essenes?
Yeah, that's not a bad... I think that's how they'd put it. We think that the Essenes do refer to the Pharisees in a few places in their writings, and they call them like a whitewashed fence, a rickety fence. The seekers after smooth things instead of seekers after the way you really should walk. And there's a word play there, because in Hebrew the word for walk is halak, and that which is smooth is pronounced almost the same way. So it's kind of a clever word play. So most scholars think that the Essenes are criticizing Pharisees, and we have a little bit of history there. You know, we've got in the books of the Maccabees and in Josephus, it talks about politics at work when the Hasmoneans threw off the Greek leadership in the second century BC and liberated Israel. The Pharisees initially supported them, and then later on there was a bad falling out between the Hasmonean leadership in Israel and the Pharisees. In fact, the Pharisees became embroiled in a plot to overthrow one of the Hasmonean kings, and this was Alexander Janaeus. The Pharisees were plotting with a Greek king named Demetrius. Well, this is actually talked about in the scrolls, and 800 Pharisees were crucified. I mean, it's quite a grisly account. Josephus tells us about it, too. Well, so does one of the commentaries of Qumran. The Pesher on Nahum talks about, you know, how these guys were crucified. Well, who were these guys that were crucified? Well, these guys who are the whitewashers, you know, of the rickety fence, people who, and of course this is alluding to scripture passages, and people who, you know, seek smooth things. So we think that, well, they must be the Pharisees. And so I think you're right. My students sometimes ask me, how come in the New Testament we hear about Sadducees and Pharisees, but we never hear about the Essenes? And I think it's because the Essenes would have ignored Jesus. The Essenes would have seen Jesus as somebody not worth looking at, because he hung around with sinners. He hung around with prostitutes, people who didn't keep the law properly. And the Pharisees found Jesus interesting because he performed miracles. He talked about the kingdom of God. He talked about resurrection. These are things that the Pharisees thought were very important. And they noticed that Jesus was, of course, very popular. People crowded around him. So they wanted to check him out. And some probably were sympathetic. And, of course, we know some Pharisees, in fact, became Christians because of the resurrection. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the Essenes would have had any interest in Jesus once they saw that, you know, he wasn't one of their members. He hung around with the wrong kind of people. He hung around with Pharisees, too, and the Essenes did not respect them. So I think an Essene wouldn't have walked across the street to hear Jesus speak. And that's probably why, therefore, we never hear about Essenes in the New Testament, even though the New Testament contains stuff that parallels some of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's not because, you know, Jesus had been an Essene, or that, you know, an Essene was one of his followers. Nothing like that. They do share a common world, a Jewish world from the first century.
Now, who were the Essenes exactly then?
Well, we think it's possible that they were a group that were surrounding some priests who had they were of the line of Zadok. Zadok was the priest that was appointed right at the end of King David's reign and was confirmed by King Solomon. And so out of respect for Zadok, and Zadok, of course, was, you know, of the tribe of Levi, and he was a descendant of the first high priest, Aaron, the brother of Moses. But Zadok was a distinctive family within that line, and so for the next several hundred years, you had to be a descendant of Zadok to become high priest. Well, that changed when the Hasmoneans succeeded in rebelling and winning their freedom from the Greeks, the Seleucids, in the 160s B.C. And then we had a Hasmonean priest instead of a Zadokite priest. And we think that that's probably what led to the trouble, the Essenes breaking away at some point in the 2nd century and eventually found themselves thrust out of Jerusalem and establishing their headquarters in the wilderness at Qumran. It was the only place where they could be safe. And that's just one theory. There are other nuances that come out of that. So they're probably a priestly group. They seem to be very concerned with priestly activities in Jerusalem, how exactly to offer sacrifice, what exactly the right calendar is, how to keep the land pure and holy and so forth. So there's probably some truth to that, but keep in mind it's a long history. The Essene community, when it was finally destroyed during the Great Rebellion against, you know, Rome, they were destroyed either in the year 68 when General Vespasian entered Jericho, which is just immediately north of the Dead Sea, or perhaps they were destroyed in the year 73 when General Silva marched down the coast of the Dead Sea to Masada to put down the final last vestiges of the rebellion. So anyway, they came to an end in 68 or 73, and that's a community which by that point would have existed for probably 150, maybe 170 years, something like that. And during its history, it would have changed. Its views probably evolved. Its leadership changed. The original teacher of righteousness had long since died. And so there would have been new ideas. They would have had to change some of their expectations about, you know, big events soon to occur. So we have to be careful when we talk about the Essenes, who they were and what they thought, because who they were and what they thought changed a bit during its lengthy history of this particular group.
Dr. Lynn Kowick, when she was on last week, she surprised me or something, because I'd always thought the Essenes were a community of celibate males, and she'd said, we found female remains at Qumran. Apparently some people did live there with their wives. I'm like, well, Craig Evans is going to be on. We'll just ask him.
Well, that is controversial. What most scholars agree is that probably most of the men at Qumran were celibate. Many of the Qumran members and Essenes probably were celibate men. However, we also know that there were some who were affiliated or full members of the Essenes who had families, had wives, had children, and lived not just at Qumran. There were at least 4,000 members of the Essenes, Josephus tells us. They couldn't have all lived at Qumran. I doubt if much more than 100 people, maybe 200 at most, ever lived at Qumran, even if they used some of the caves nearby as dwelling places. But as far as women at Qumran is concerned, one of the problems is the skeletons are so poorly preserved. You know, there's a cemetery to the immediate southeast of the Qumran compound. There's a wall that separates it, as Jewish tradition would require. So you bury people outside the city limits, outside the wall. And of course, what happened was in the Middle Ages and even in more recent times, right up to the 19th century, some of the Bedouin, you know, buried their own dead in that cemetery. So, and that would include females as well. And so that has complicated the remains. Now, we usually can tell the difference between a Bedouin grave and an Essene grave. The Essene graves were all a certain style, a certain way of doing it, the way the bodies were positioned and so forth. But that has complicated things. And so what we think when we're talking about just the skeletons that date back to the Essene period, that is no more recent than the first century A.D., we think that there are very, very few, maybe none at all, female skeletons. But we haven't dug up all of them. There are hundreds. So they haven't all been exhumed and examined. And what skeletons have been exhumed and examined are not always in good enough condition where we can determine the gender. So that's why it's a little fuzzy. So I agree with Professor Koech in saying that we think that there are some female skeletons in the cemetery, and that would agree with what our sources tell us, that some of the Essenes, in fact, were married, had wives, had children. So we should not think of all Essenes as celibate men. That's just not true.
It was a surprise to me because I thought the Essenes, by and large, had a kind of negative view of women, which was also one of the reasons it's suspected. I thought that they never copied the Book of Esther, for instance.
Well, let me interject. You know, there were a lot of Jewish men like Pharisees and some of the early rabbis. They were married, they had wives, and they had negative views of women.
Mm-hmm.
So just because you're married doesn't mean that you necessarily value a liberated, free-spirited woman, you know, or
right.
Held her in high regard. A lot of men in those days did not. And that's one of the positive things that the Christian church did, was elevate the status of women.
Absolutely.
I know it's popular to think that the church held women back, but that's not what was happening back then. Women were not always treated, well, they were not treated as equals by Greeks or Romans, and I can show you texts that speak very disparagingly of women, how they should keep silent, how they should not speak in the presence of men. Silence is their crown, silence is their jewel. You know, that those kinds of statements like that, and you see that in early rabbinic texts too. So that was the view among at least some early Jews, that women, you know, were inferior to men and should stay at home and should stay quiet. And so I wouldn't single out the Essenes for special treatment. They probably reflected what was generally the held view among Jewish people at that time, and a view that was not very feminist in orientation, held by Greeks and Romans at that time.
And
this idea that, you know, when Paul in his letter to the Galatians says that in Christ there's neither male nor female, neither slave nor free, neither Jew nor Greek, I mean, that kind of a statement is extraordinary. That would be inflammatory.
Yeah.
We accept it today. We think, oh, yes, that's very enlightened. That's the way it ought to be. That's how we today take it. But I'll tell you, when he wrote those words in the middle of the first century A.D., that he was way, way ahead of his time.
Yeah, if anyone's more interested in this, I can recommend that you listen to last week's show of Lynn Koech, where we talked all about Christianity and women. Like, I was even thinking that when we talked about the Ephesians passage in that show, when we got to the line where they said, well, wives submit to your husbands, most of the husbands in the audience are saying, amen, preach it, Paul, preach it. And, but then when he gets to love your wives as Christ loved the church, most of the men were probably going, Paul, what are you smoking right now?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's correct. And some people, again, it goes back to the idea of being choosy, very selective. Mm-hmm. And some people who think that women have a secondary role to play in the church, they'll cite two passages in the New Testament and ignore the other 11 that suggest that women are equal with men in leadership positions in the church. They could be apostles, ministers, workers in the church, and so on, and that's the way the early church treated them. And then they'll point to just two passages, like the one in 1 Timothy chapter 2, and even there, when they go there about women ought to learn quietly and so on, they'll ignore the passage that talks about how men ought to behave as well and lift their hands, holy hands, free of violence. And men will ignore that. They'll say, well, I don't have to lift my hands when I pray. But then they'll turn right around and impose a dress code or a silent code of silence on women. It's really funny how that is. And Paul is talking cultural things that make sense in his own time. And when he's talking about a theological principle of equality, well, then it's Galatians 3:28 that I quoted earlier about how in Christ there's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither male nor female, slave nor free. And that's when he spells out the implications of the gospel, Whereas in the First Timothy passage, he's talking about some cultural trappings that people should be aware of if the gospel is to be respected. I mean, that's the way it is in the world today. I know missionaries who are in places where Muslims live. And, you know, if you want to get the Muslims to listen and talk about the Bible or talk about Christian faith, you better respect their culture. And that means women have, you know, because that's the way it is in the Islamic world, a woman needs to keep quiet and not be in public telling men what to do or, you know, seen as the principal speaker. It just wouldn't work in that kind of a culture. And I think that's part of what Paul is talking about in 1 Timothy chapter 2.
Now, getting back to the Essenes, before we get to the New Testament looking at them, they really helped us tremendously with the Old Testament, especially since our oldest manuscripts think the Masoretic text went to around 900 AD or so, and then boom, all of a sudden, here we have some from 150 BC, and by golly, they look remarkably similar.
Yep, that's a good point. In fact, that was the first thing that was noticed when John Trevor took his photographs of the Great Isaiah Scroll in 1948. He photographed them initially in February of 48, and then for publication he photographed them again, beautiful color photographs. You can get them in color or black and white. He did that in April of 1948. And, of course, scholars had the opportunity immediately to compare word for word the Hebrew text of the Great Isaiah Scroll, which usually is dated to around 150 B.C., some dated perhaps a little bit earlier, even to 200 B.C. But in any case, you then can compare it to the Leningrad Codex, which dates to about 1000 A.D., or the parts of the Aleppo Codex, which is 50, 60 years older than that. And in any case, you could make this comparison, and of course, it's noticed that the Hebrew text is almost, I say almost, but it's almost identical. There are some scribal errors, some readings that are a little bit different. We don't always know if it was a slip of the pen or deliberate, but the text is 99% the same. And so that answered skeptics who thought, well, you know, if our oldest Isaiah dates somewhere between A.D. 900 and 1000, and Isaiah wrote his scroll back, say, 700 B.C., you know, we're 16, 17 centuries removed. Maybe there all kinds of changes have taken place. Maybe people added chapters or took away chapters, added several verses here or there, altered things. Well, we jump back in time 1,000 years or so, and the text is 99% the same. We don't find 67 chapters in the Great Isaiah Scroll instead of 66. We don't find 58 chapters instead of 66. Isaiah 53, the passage about the suffering servant, the Messiah who suffers for his people, that passage doesn't disappear. It's there it is in the Great Isaiah Scroll 150 years before the birth of Jesus. So that's very significant, and of course we could multiply that and go text by text. 38 of the 39 Old Testament books have been recovered, some of them just small portions, but are represented at Qumran. So they had basically the same Bible that makes up today's Old Testament. So that is a very significant feature, one of the great values of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
I'm guessing that's why you did your dissertation on Isaiah as well.
Yeah, I did my dissertation on Isaiah because I was really curious to see how Isaiah was interpreted, especially a famous passage in the vision of God's God sitting on the throne in the temple, Isaiah chapter 6. I wanted to know how Isaiah was understood at Qumran, interpreted and preserved, but also elsewhere in early Christianity and in the rabbis. So that's what my dissertation was all about, and that, of course, drew me further into the scrolls. I had Bill Brownlee as my supervisor, and this is a man who was, as I said earlier, in Israel in 1947 and 48 when the first cave was discovered. And so he saw the scrolls. He was one of the very first Western scholars, one of two or three people, to see the scrolls. And actually, he brought the Isaiah scroll home with him. A lot of people don't know that. He taught Hebrew at Duke University in the fall of 1948 after his 1 year in Israel. And he actually had the Great Isaiah Scroll on loan with him in a shoebox. And, he unrolled it, for students to look at. And, when he taught Hebrew, he would go and speak at various colleges and churches. And he'd say, oh, here's the Great Isaiah Scroll. And he didn't have a car when he first returned to North Carolina in 1948. And so an underclassman at the university, a student named Isaac, roomed with him for that first semester, and he had a car, and he drove Professor Brownlee around. And I'd heard that story from Dr. Brownlee, and I was lecturing a number of years ago in North Carolina, and I just mentioned that story, the one I just now told you. Mm-hmm. And an elderly man jumped up in the audience, waving his arms, and he said, "That's me, I'm Isaac." I was just astounded. The guy who drove Bill Brownlee around in the car with the Great Isaiah Scroll in a shoebox, there he was in the audience. This is about 15 years ago. I was absolutely stunned. And we had lunch together, and we talked, and it was just great to meet this man. He's long since died, but that was quite a surprise.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back. We'll be discussing the impact of the Dead Sea Scrolls on New Testament and Christianity. I'm Nick Peters. My guest is Professor Craig Evans on the Deeper Waters podcast. We'll be back after this.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcasts, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And people, I'd like you to remember that if you really like what you're hearing here, and I hope you do, and if you want to support it, your donations are really essential to this. And this is what keeps us going. And if you want to make a donation to us, you can go to Blog Talk Radio. But if you want to make a donation to Deeper Waters directly, you can go to my blog at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. Find a link there how to donate. You can donate through tectonics.org with my ministry partner, J.P. Holding. And might I point out, we've just released a new ebook together about Christian answers for today's generation. You can find it on Amazon. It's about $3. And yes, some of the proceeds go to support Deeper Waters. I encourage you to get that. You can support us through Risen Jesus, the ministry of Mike Lacona. Just say that these are for us. And you can also support me through the Ratio Christi Issues and Answers chapter. As you can tell, I wear many, many hats. Now, our guest right now is Professor Craig Evans. We're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And Professor Evans, you'd said that Jesus and New Testament figures aren't mentioned, so someone in the audience could be thinking, well, if Jesus isn't mentioned, and this is so long before Christianity, about 100, 150 years or so, what impact can these really have in helping us understand the New Testament?
Well, that's a very good question. So the impact the scrolls make in helping us understand Jesus and Christian origins isn't because the scrolls say anything about Jesus directly, because they do not. But they talk about the same topics. They share some of the same interpretations of Scripture. They anticipate future events in some ways that's similar. For example, 4Q246, let me unpack that and explain it. That means Qumran's, that's what the Q stands for, cave number four. So the fourth cave, the big cave, the one that had 600 documents in it, it has several Aramaic ones. Most of the scrolls are Hebrew, but about 10% of them are Aramaic. Well, this small Aramaic text is just one piece of leather. That's all it is, two columns of text, nine lines in each, on each column, in Aramaic, speaks of the coming of somebody who will be called Son of God, Son of the Most High, who will reign forever and will be called great. Now, when you hear that, you immediately think, wait a minute, isn't that what the angel Gabriel said to Mary in Luke chapter 1? And that's correct. It's called the Annunciation. And there are four components that the angel shares with Mary. You will have a son. He will be great. He will be called Son of God. He will be called Son of the Most High, and he will reign on the throne of his father David forever. And so we have those four things in this Aramaic text. That's amazing. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us the idea that the Messiah would be called Son of God was an idea that was circulating in Aramaic even before Jesus was born, and that's not an idea that developed later when early Christians were proclaiming Jesus in the Gentile world. They didn't decide to call Jesus God's Son because that's what the Romans said about Caesar. It's, in fact, this is an idea that's before this engagement with the Roman world. It's in Aramaic, the very language of Jesus and his mother Mary. It's in Palestine. And so that's why these texts help us. Now, here's another one. This is also from cave number 4. It's document number 521, a section called the Messianic Apocalypse. It talks about a Messiah, God's Messiah, whom the heavens and the earth will obey. And when he comes, the blind will regain their sight. Those who are ill or sick will be raised up. Those who are poor or downtrodden will have good news proclaimed to them. Now, as soon as you hear that, you think, wait a minute, that is so similar to what Jesus said to John the Baptist. John's in prison, awaiting execution, unfortunately. Herod Antipas, the tetrarch, had arrested him. So John, very discouraged, sends messengers to Jesus saying, are you really the one who is to come, or should we look for somebody else? And Jesus says, well, go back and tell John that the blind regain their sight, lepers are cleansed, the dead are raised up, the poor have good news, preach to them. And so you can see Jesus summed up his messianic ministry in a way that was very similar to what we find in this one scroll. So this scroll, number 521, tells us that when the Messiah comes, sick people are healed, and even the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them. And so Jesus sees himself as doing the messianic task, and that's the whole point of it. And so scrolls like that help us understand better Jesus' words and his teachings and his deeds. Here's another example relating to Paul. Paul talks about how no one can be justified in the sight of God by doing works of the law. And he emphasized that in the books, his letter to the churches of Galatia, and also in his famous letter to the Romans. Well, at Qumran in K4 are six copies of a letter that talks about how the law is supposed to be obeyed. And it goes on to say that if you do these things, the works of the law, it will be reckoned to you as righteousness. And it's amazing the parallel with Paul. It's not that Paul read that letter or that that letter had read Paul. Of course not. The letter's 100 years old when Paul was writing. But what it shows is there's a difference of opinion in Israel in Paul's day. There are some who say there are certain works of the law that you have to do to be declared righteous. And then your eternity will be all wrapped up. You'll be, don't worry, you'll go to heaven, you'll be okay with God. Paul is saying, no, you can't work your way into heaven. You can't do the works of the law and be justified. That's not what's going on there. You have to do it some other way. So this particular text at Qumran, or six copies of a legal letter, helps us then understand what Paul is arguing about, who his opponents are, why he says what he says. And I could give you other examples, like Melchizedek. Why does the author of Hebrews compare Jesus to Melchizedek? As though Melchizedek is a really significant figure for helping us to understand who Jesus really was and the significance of his death and the significance of his ongoing work in heaven interceding on behalf of his people. Well, at Qumran, they have a text from Cave 11. It's all focused on Melchizedek, and it turns out he's this superhero who will defeat the devil, who will forgive the sins of his people, and who will lead them, ultimately bring the kingdom of God and lead them to salvation. And you realize, well, wait a minute. If that's how they understood Melchizedek, and Melchizedek, you know, he met Abraham in Genesis 14. If that's who Melchizedek was, and that's how he was understood, no wonder the author of the New Testament book called Hebrews, no wonder he makes comparison between Jesus and Melchizedek. So these are the kinds of things we learn when we read the scrolls, and they help us understand better the logic, the purpose, the style of argument, the exegesis that goes on in the New Testament writings.
It's so amusing because when you were saying, I think it was 4Q521, was that the number about the...
That's the text that talks about the blind regaining their sight and the poor having good news preached to them.
Yeah, I just opened my Bible thing. I think I've heard this is another one, then you went straight into that one. And yeah, this works out very well. And so when we see these texts, I think another example of the way we've seen the Dead Sea Scrolls influence is that the Gospel of John was seen as depicting a sort of struggle between light and darkness, good and evil, this sort of thought. That kind of dualism didn't really exist in Jewish thought. And then, lo and behold, we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yep, that's another good example. In the one that I've talked about earlier, the Rule Scroll, Sirach, the rule of the community, in columns 3 and 4, we have numerous parallels with the Gospel of John. And it does. It contrasts, as you just said, light and darkness. It contrasts flesh and spirit, error and truth, and things like that, a dualism that runs throughout columns 3 and 4 of 1QS, that is the Sirach scroll from Qumran, Cave 1. And so instead of appealing to Gnosticism, which really is later, it's 2nd century AD, we can appeal to the earlier Qumran texts that were still being read and studied and talked about in the early decades of the 1st century AD, and that then becomes a much better background for understanding the Gospel of John, where we find similar dualism contrasting light and darkness, truth and falsehood, you know, people who are of God's spirit as opposed to people who are of their father, the devil. You know, that kind of language, which, you know, it's a Qumran. So John is seen to reflect Palestine. After all, Palestinian Judaism had not some later Gnostic thinking.
Now, when we were talking earlier about conspiracies, there are some that are pretty interesting also in relation to New Testament now. You've already said that Jesus isn't mentioned. No New Testament figures are mentioned. No Gospels have been found in the scrolls, but there are some strange ideas. I'm thinking especially about Barbara Fehring's ideas about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Could you expound on those some?
Well, yeah. Okay, I'm glad you brought up Barbara Fehring. She's an Australian scholar, retired. I know her. I actually sat right next to her in a Jeep that was driving through the Judean desert back in the summer of 1997. And so she shared with me her views personally, and I'm aware of her books, and in Fabricating Jesus I talk about it. But I'm not aware of any scholar, there may be lay people who aren't scholars, but I'm not aware of any scholar who takes her views seriously. They are extremely eccentric. What she does, she knows that Jesus' name does not appear in the scrolls, that Jesus, Mary, and other Bible figures, New Testament figures, are not mentioned in the scrolls. She knows that, but she thinks they're hinted at, and so she deciphers the scrolls. She thinks they're full of symbolism, and so she finds, on the basis of her curious interpretation of the scrolls, she thinks Jesus was married, later divorced, later remarried, celebrated the Eucharist years after his crucifixion, which somehow he survived. With Dr. Luke. I mean, it just goes on and on. It is some of the strangest stuff I've ever heard of. I'm not real sure who the strangest person is, Tom Harper, who doesn't think Jesus existed, or Barbara Fehring, who sees the scrolls and the New Testament Gospels as these ciphers that are full of all kinds of hidden meanings. It's very subjective. I mean, it's impossible. You know, I mean, how do you argue for it or against it? because it is so subjective. So I don't mean any disrespect to her as a person, but her views are viewed as extremely eccentric, and as I said, I'm not sure that a single scholar on planet Earth agrees with her.
There are sometimes I tell people there are some arguments that I'm just not sure how I'd answer. It's not because they're so brilliant, it's because they're so far out there that you can't believe anyone holds that position.
Well, you know, I mean, if you're subjective and you say, look, I had a dream or some vision or somebody told me something and this is what it now means, I mean, how do you really argue against that? All you can say is, well, that's very subjective, it's very private, it's very personal, and it's impossible to test it. You know, it is outside the canons of the way people normally think. It's outside the way historians operate. So if you want to enter your private world of symbols that mean almost anything you say they mean, well, fine. But nobody, you know, if no other person should follow you there. You really need to interpret things the way you can show, for which you can show evidence, where you can say, you know, the Kittim refer to the Romans or a Western power, and you can show that in text, and you don't turn it into something else and say, well, it's really in reference to this or that. And when, you know, there's a reference to water somewhere, that's not a reference to Christian baptism. It's not a reference to Jesus being baptized by John. You know, and if there's a reference to this or that, a circle or something, that's not Jesus' wedding ring when he married Mary Magdalene. You know what? You know, and this kind of stuff is so subjective that, you know, it cannot be confirmed, you know, at all, and there's no reason to follow somebody with that kind of interpretation. And nobody has.
You mentioned Tom Harper. If I'm correct, he's a Canadian journalist.
That's right.
He really jumped off a bandwagon with Christ myth theory and such. What does he have some bizarre view on the Dead Sea Scrolls as well?
Well, it's not so much the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's a bizarre view of the Gospels themselves. And what he says is the Gospels are just these giant parables, and they're not really talking about a real person that ever lived. Jesus is an embodiment of an Egyptian myth. An Egyptian religious idea about true light. There's this ultimate source of light comes from God, and so the Gospels are nothing more than a way of narrating that, sort of a narrative theology that explains this true light that shines, and the evidence for Jesus is non-existent. He really didn't exist. So it's a very bizarre view. He's actually going back to theosophy. It's an idea that developed mostly in the 19th century, and these pseudo-Egyptologists, a couple of men who had no confidence whatever in Egyptology, a guy named Alvin Boyd Kuhn and another guy named Gerald Massey.
They
lived at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, and they cooked up this theosophical view about this Egyptian myth. And I think their idea, you know, in a way, it's kind of a... it's wishful thinking. It's like, you know, the whole world can become one. We can put every idea about God, all religions, in a blender, push the button, and then blend it all together and pour a gray soup into a cup, and we can all share it. We all have the same views. It's some kind of radical ecumenism in that sense, but it's nothing but mush. Real Egyptologists, historians, scholars ignore them. They see them as eccentric. Unfortunately, among non-scholars, some people follow that stuff, and that would include Tom Harper. For whatever reason, I mean, at one time he considered himself an Anglican minister and Christian. At one time, he actually taught Greek at a respectable seminary. But something began to change in the 1980s and in the 90s, at the end of the 90s, beginning of the 21st century, he decided Jesus didn't exist, and he started writing books to that effect, and one of them, 10 years ago, was called The Pagan Christ, and that got a lot of attention.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, and of course, the real historians and scholars think it's silly and have refuted it or ignored it, mostly, and that's where we are today.
Yes, welcome to the internet where dead ideas rise up to new life constantly.
Yep, that's a good way of putting it.
We're going to take our final break, and when we come back, we're going to be wrapping things up with Professor Craig Evans. I'm Nick Peters for Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That again is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
We're back. We're wrapping up our show, and I don't know about you all, but I have found today's conversation fascinating. I've enjoyed all Professor Evans' information, and his style and delivery is just hysterical. I love it. So great. And we're going to start wrapping things up now. There's a lot of people, I'm sure, who are wondering, because we've only been able to really scratch the surface on the Dead Sea Scrolls here. If someone's saying, hey, you know, I'm really intrigued, I want to know more, I want to find a way to sort through all the conspiracies and things of that sort, where would you recommend they go?
Well, there's a great book by Jim Vanderkam and Peter Flint. It came out a decade ago, published by HarperCollins, a big publisher, and it introduces the Dead Sea Scrolls and explains what they're all about. So that's one place. And if you don't mind, I could mention my own book that came out a few years ago.
By all means.
And it's a guide to the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's in a guide series that B&H, Brodmann and Holman, publishes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a guide to the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's full of pictures and illustrations, maps, and so on. It keeps it pretty simple. It's for the beginner.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out, I think, in 2000, I'm not real sure, 2010 perhaps, Guide to the Dead Sea Scrolls, Rodman and Holman. Mm-hmm. And it'll answer all these questions like, who found the scrolls and when were they found, cave by cave, related finds, who the scholars were, what the scrolls are, you know, they're all summarized and described, what light they shed on Jesus and the early church and the New Testament documents, what light they shed on early Judaism, too.
Mm-hmm.
And do they shed light on the Old Testament? And, of course, they do. And so mm-hmm. that's what it is. And so I try to keep it lively. I talk about the destruction of the Qumran community by the Romans. I suggest that it happened in the year 73 when General Silva was marching toward Masada. I talk about the archaeology, the different caves that were found, what was found in them, and some of the related mm-hmm. caves, including, you know, like the Nahal Hever caves where we actually found bones and various things. So it's an interesting story, and I talk about Kando and how, you know, a machine gun was pointed at his house. You know, and he was told to give up the temple scroll. I mean, there's some pretty interesting stuff in this book. So if people want to learn about the scrolls, what the real scholars actually say about the scrolls, what they really are, and not the sensationalists and the conspiracy people on the Internet, my book or the book by Jim Vanderkam and Peter Flint, I think they're pretty reliable guides. And of course, there are many other books, too. It isn't just my book out there, but there are other good books on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking here on Amazon. I'm seeing several books right now. This is the Holman Quick Source Guide to the Dead Sea Scrolls you were just talking about.
Yeah,
right?
That's the book. Yeah.
Okay, well, if anyone's interested, it's available for $12.48 on paperback, $9.99 on Kindle. And I think the one you're talking about by Vanderkam, would that be the Dead Sea Scrolls Today?
That would be one of them, yeah. Then he has one that he did with Peter Flint, and it's Harper. I think the Dead Sea Scrolls Today is with Erdmans, and
mm-hmm.
the one with Flint is by HarperCollins.
Mm-hmm. Is there, by chance, also maybe a website or anything that people can go to if they want to see pictures of the Dead Sea Scrolls, or maybe even get to read some of what the scrolls themselves say?
Well, yeah, there are some websites. Off the top of my head, I can't give you the actual address, but I'm pretty sure the Shrine of the Book, if you go to the Shrine of the Book, whatever its website address is, that's where the scrolls are kept, or at least some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the Orion Center. I believe they make scroll images available, too. You can actually see pictures of the scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
And it is exciting. I mean, it's a different world. And when I was a PhD student long ago, I mean, we didn't have these kind of tools. We'd have been willing to kill for them. I'm kidding. But it had been, I mean, just think that at your fingertips, you could have pictures of these scrolls and the texts and, you know, and their Bible search software, you know, like Accordance, which has the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was the first to have the Dead Sea Scrolls in Hebrew and Aramaic and English translation. But now you have Bible Works also, and you have Logos.
Mm-hmm.
They're all very fine software programs, and so you can access the scrolls, the Hebrew Bible, you know, the Greek New Testament, the Greek Old Testament, English translations. I mean, all of this stuff is available now, complete with pictures and things too. And it's an exciting time to be involved in this kind of research.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be going crazy with my wish list on Amazon shortly after the show. I did just do some looking for Shrine of the Book, and what I found is dss.collections.imj.org.il. For anyone's interested, I'm seeing the home screen. It's got Great Isaiah Scroll, War Scroll, Commentary on Habakkuk Scroll, Temple Scroll, and Community Rule Scroll.
Yeah, good job, Nick. I think you found it. And that should answer the conspiracy people, you know, as a matter of fact. What conspiracy? Mm-hmm. The doggone scrolls are online. You can go look at them. Who's hiding anything?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Vatican, you know, they're not hiding anything. The Jews in Jerusalem, they're not hiding anything. It's all there. You can look at them. And, of course, they're all published. They're expensive books, but there they are. They're in libraries. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to look at a scroll, look at it. You want to read the text? In Hebrew, it's there. If you want to read it in English translation, it's there. Or German, or French, or Spanish. There is no conspiracy. These things are available.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so my answer to the internet skeptic is, look, you know, get an education. Read some good books. Find out what the experts really say. Quit listening to the quacks. Learn something, you know. You've got a brain. Use it.
Yeah, when I've been in debates with some of these people, and I've said, use scholarly sources, and they say, well, what counts as a scholar? And I'll say, well, okay, that's a good question. Here's what you do. Look for someone who's in a field relevant to the topic. Look for someone who's got a PhD. Look for someone who teaches at an accredited university or has in the past taught at an accredited university, maybe retired since then. And look for someone whose work on a subject has passed peer review.
Yeah, see, that's good advice. You're telling people the right thing. Some people get so caught up in this conspiracy stuff, they think all of the scholars, including me, are all part of some big, huge, vast conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're dealing with that, you're dealing with a person that's borderline paranoid. I don't know what to tell them. But you're giving them the right advice. You know, people who have proper training, proper education, proper credentials, and are recognized as such, and that means, you know, they're on a faculty somewhere, a real school that gives accredited degrees, and these are people who know what. But it doesn't mean that we're always right, and it doesn't mean that, you know, you can't have the odd crackpot once in a while, even in that setting. But on the whole, it's a pretty good safeguard against really eccentric, wrong-headed stuff that's typically promoted on the Internet or something like that.
Yeah, and of course it doesn't mean that the scholar is always right. It just means their opinion is of greater authority than the average layperson, because even amongst Christian scholars, there's definitely disagreement on various issues. And, of course, what we also want to look at is not just what scholar says X, but even more importantly, why does a scholar say X? And in each of these cases, if you're going to your opponents and you're presenting peer review and such, you always want to make sure your arguments are as good as you can make them.
Well, of course. And see, real scholarship means that the evidence is trotted out. It's presented. There it is. You cite chapter and verse. Here's the picture of it. This is how the text reads. This is what the scientific study of it shows. The text is real. It's authentic. Mm-hmm. It dates back to, you know, 100 BC or something. And by the way, it's in a museum now, or it's in Jerusalem, and you can go see it. So it really does exist. And that's what real scholarship does. It lays out the evidence that's public. Everybody can look at it and consider it. And then the arguments are made publicly. Here's why I think it means this and that. I'm not giving you anything eccentric. This is what the Hebrew word means. You can look it up in a dictionary. That's what real scholarship does. And then it's vetted. It's refereed, as it were. Other scholars look at it and they respond and say, well, I agree with most of what you say, but I think you should reconsider this part. Oh, okay. And so you go back and forth. That's what scholars do. But these eccentrics on online internet stuff, conspiracy buffs, they don't do that. And so it becomes a very private world unto itself where anything goes, almost anything can mean anything.
And a lot of people are also thinking, we were talking about, well, this is biblical scholarship, and that field is dominated by Christians. And I was like, well, actually, it's my understanding that a large portion, if not most, of SBL, the Society of Biblical Literature, for instance, is non-Christians. And scholars, be they Christians or non-Christians, they have their work checked by people who disagree with them ideologically, in fact.
Well, that's true. You know, I don't know who dominates SBL. There are lots and lots of Christians who are at SBL, but you get different kinds, conservative, moderate, liberal. You have Jewish scholars, you know, hundreds of Jewish scholars, maybe 1,000, you know, for all I know. As many as 10,000 people show up at these meetings each year in November. Mm-hmm. So you get a wide, wide cross-selection of scholars. Many of them are secular. They could be agnostic. Maybe even some of them are atheists. And they get together and they share their knowledge. They have expertise in a variety of fields. Some people are brilliant when it comes to languages. Some people know archaeology like nobody's business. Some people are historians. And they come together and they share their information. They critique one another. We go away, we learn a lot of stuff. And, you know, I've presented papers and I've had good questions raised. And I think, you know what? I need to rethink that. This part of my argument might be wrong. And maybe I need to change it. And that's what real scholarship does. And the Society of Biblical Literature, and it's only one of many. I also belong to the Society of New Testament Studies. There's also a Society of Old Testament Studies. You've got societies relating to history, archaeology, papyrology, and so forth. And so you get the world's best scholars getting together, sharing their information. You've got real archaeologists every year digging in Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Turkey, Greece, Italy, and elsewhere, unearthing things, you know, new things. And the study goes on and on. There are tens of thousands of papyrus documents recovered from Egypt that still haven't been fully studied or published yet. And the work just goes on, and exciting. And what I like about it is it's real stuff. We're not just dreaming up stories. There are museums filled with artifacts. You can go look at them. You can touch them. They're real. Manuscripts that are real. We're not talking about airy-fairy ideas that my grandmother told me. We're talking about real stuff that anybody can look at, handle, and study. And that makes, for me, that makes the field very exciting. It's just not a bunch of theories, but it's a lot of stuff, a lot of evidence that demands being carefully scrutinized and interpreted. And so that gets me up every morning and keeps me going.
And there's no excuse in today's world for someone who wants to argue this stuff to not get an education. You can go to your library, you can go to a local university or seminary library. Even if you're on your computer, you can just open some like iTunes University or something and listen to courses from great educators, and all of this for free. So there's no excuse for ignorance today.
No, I agree. That's right. Anybody that wants to learn and get going can find good stuff. And a lot of the good stuff is online, by the way.
Yes.
It's not all bad. Mm-hmm. And if you do make an attempt, read some good books, you'll get a sense of the lay of the land, who the real scholars are, what the real publishers are, books worth reading, and you can tell them and distinguish them from the junk books and for and from the quacks who don't know what they're talking about.
Well, Professor Evans, we've got a little over 5 minutes left in the show, so it's time that we really start wrapping things up. What final message would you like to leave with my audience about Dead Sea Scrolls and Christianity or anything related to that?
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to say a little bit about it. I want to say, first of all, that the Dead Sea Scrolls really are important documents. They're a library. I think most of those books would have been in an early church library if they had been available. Not that all early Christians would have agreed with them, but they would have been just glad for the information. They'd have found it very useful to compare and learn about how Scripture was interpreted at Qumran. And the text, books were valuable in antiquity. They were priceless. A complete Bible would cost as much as buying a car today. Extremely valuable, these things. And so I want to say the scrolls are important. They're worth reading. The scrolls don't contain any embarrassing secrets or things that, would somehow refute the Christian faith or make Jesus look strange. Jesus is not mentioned. Paul isn't mentioned. John the Baptist isn't there. Nobody says anything about Mary Magdalene. The scrolls contain lots of useful insights about the Old Testament, the text of the Old Testament, how Jesus' teaching should be understood, because there's things that Jesus say that we now understand better thanks to the scrolls. Same thing with Paul. So the scrolls are worthwhile. But the scrolls are just the scrolls. They're just one window, one access point to the world of Jesus. They're not everything. The scrolls don't explain everything. It's important to visit the land of Israel, to see the lay of the land, to visit the archaeological digs, to visit the museums, to see the things that have been found that are being studied and interpreted. You know, go there and learn. There are lots of good books, some of them with beautiful pictures in them, that will introduce readers to the world of Jesus in the early church or the land of the Bible. Introductions that explain the scriptures. And so there are some good books. So that's what I'd like to... I'm an educator. I'm a professor. I'm in my 34th year of teaching biblical literature. So I would encourage your hearers and listeners to get some good books. And if you live someplace where you can take a course, maybe online or in person, which is better, do so. Learn. Get some good teachers, read some good books, and learn. The church, in my view, is uneducated. The church is biblically illiterate. So I'd like to see that get fixed and fixed soon.
Yeah, that's the kind of final thing that I'm kind of thinking. I'd like to have an altar call after that one there. Now, if someone wants to find out more about you, do you have a website they can go to?
Yes, I do. www.craigaevans.com. And Craig A. Evans, just no punctuation marks, just Craig A. Evans. You can find me online real easily.
Well, Professor Evans, it has been a real treat, and with your being an educator, I can certainly tell you I certainly got a whole lot out of this show today as well. I've really enjoyed having you on, and I hope we'll see you on here again sometime.
Well, you did a great job interviewing me, and I appreciate having the chance to talk about what I think is a very important topic.
Well, we're going to be signing off now, and I'd like to remind everyone, next week we're going to be talking about another important topic. Mary Jo Sharp from HBU is going to be here. We're going to be talking about why apologetics. So for now, I'm Nick Peters, thanking again my guest, Professor Craig Evans. And I encourage you to check out his work, and yes, to please educate yourselves. And that includes both of us. We are still constantly learning. For now, I am Nick Peters, signing off. We'll see you next week.